I have the distinct pleasure of introducing myself. I also wanted to acknowledge collaboration of my colleague, Dr. Karen Garrett at Kansas State University. She's really the plant, the pest and disease person, and I'm the soils person. So if you notice a distinct soils bias to this this presentation, that's because I'm talking. What I want to do today in this presentation is really talk a little bit about the significance of pest, disease, and soil constraints that already exist for agricultural production, and also talk a little bit about the a kind of a model for understanding the dynamics that are involved with climate change and its impacts on these conditions. And then, as we have had a theme, I guess, in this symposium, take a case study and provide you with some examples of where we do have some detailed information about some of these impacts. And in particular, we're going to focus on the Andean Highland Plateau region, which is also called the Altiplano. I want to talk about the importance of the region, why this is a good region to study in this regard. Also, what have been the effects on soil properties and processes of climate change. Also talk about effects on the disease and pest severity and distribution, and some adaptations that might be researched and examined. Of course, in this region, there are already extensive adaptations that we can learn from that people there, the native farmers, have already managed for centuries. Also, looking at some knowledge gaps and needs for further understanding this process. The soil plant disease constraints are currently very large in terms of acting as limitations to agricultural production in developing countries. I've come across statistics that show everything from about 30 some odd percent to this one, which is about 42% of yield loss due to the insects and disease. And of course, we could also count weeds in there as ones that cause major loss. Both pre-harvest and post-harvest are really fairly significant. Of course, farmers, as Corinne has been talking about, farmers have perceptions of what are their major constraints. If you look here in this top slide, this is from one of the particular communities that Corinne is describing, where we've been doing some research. And this is their perception of what are the major constraints for their agricultural production. In the gray are the main constraints, and as she noted, for some of the communities, crop pests are really major. And of course, soils may be less so, but of course still may cause major yield loss. And notice here, too, that climate is a major constraint, as we might imagine. And so this could be potentially a much larger constraint. If we're going to understand what the consequences of climate change are on soil degradation, for example, we really have to see that, for example, we look at soil degradation, that it's really mitigated by several factors. Some of these, of course, would be soil resilience, or basically the properties of the native soil, the resource that you have, and its capacity to buffer against change. And, of course, that is different depending on the soil resource that you are on. Also, climate and weather is a major one. That's going to have an impact on soil degradation. Management factors often are going to either mitigate or accelerate some of the impacts. And so as we're examining these changes that are coming due to climate change, oftentimes we'll see possibly an acceleration of the degradation due to human activities. And of course, there's another factor that causes this to be not uniform around the world, and that's particular landscape factors such as the vegetation and landscape position and in other situations. And so in the end, we get some degradation processes that can occur. And these then, I'm just not artistically inclined. I couldn't do arrows coming back, but this is all feedback on these. And so once we get soil degradation, we can have this spiraling down as they feed back onto the soil resilience. So the soil resilience's capacity is decreasing over time. And so this is a situation which makes this quite complex. And so it's difficult to understand fully what's going to be the consequence of a shift in one factor. And as I mentioned, these are not uniform across the world, but where we're seeing where there are going to be severe implications tend to be where we have food insecure regions. And so this is unfortunate in that where the biggest impacts are probably in the place that can at least afford it. Similarly, when we're looking at disease situations, we also have to understand the complexity that's there. And typically, when we're looking at disease, we need to look at this relationship between the host factors, the pathogen factors, and the environment. And Karen Garrett has looked at impacts on climate change and considers that part of environment and notices that that's going to have some implications for the host, in the pathogen, and these also interact to moderate each other. So there's this big interaction which may in the end either cause consequences where we either have change that's favorable for disease or change that may be skewed in one of those factors versus the other. And Karen Garrett has also written in looking not only at as Angie was talking about, we may look at this on a regional basis. What she was doing was also examining this on various biological scales, not only looking at the larger scale, but also maybe down to the expression of genes, disease resistance. And so in this case, this is indicating what's happening with the host-pathogen interactions at the cellular level. And so when we get a change in temperature, that may change that expression of the disease resistance. And this can then impact some of the larger scale situations where we get greater disease, and then potentially we get, greater inoculum, which then can be moved regionally to other locations. So in this case, she's introducing this concept that not only we look at climate change on one scale, but at several biological scales. Now, one of the reasons why we have focused on the Altiplano as a region of interest for examining climate change is it happens to be one of the poorest regions in the world, and it has a really high vulnerability for climate-related shocks affecting crop production. And this particular region has gone through climate change. The Incan Empire, and there's quite a few very interesting studies about the Incan Empire and how they dealt with climate change. And one of them indicates that a warming trend significantly affected the rise of the civilization, in which they were able to develop some real effective indigenous practices for adapting to climate change. And one of them is these irrigated terraces, which you can go see in various locations around that region. So there really is a history here of adapting to climate change and managing climate change. And we see that currently, where there's a real ability to deal with that situation. But of course, this can be such an extreme which they're not going to be able to manage. And then we already can see, many of you are familiar with the information about this rapid glacial retreat, and Angie has reported about the average increase that's happened in historically. So this is way above the norm, and so we've already seen an impact of climate change in this region. So it's a very good location to examine this. And there are various, and we are repeating a lot here, I'm afraid, but we have seen some work that's indicated that the climate change here can go up to 6°C by the end of the century. So we might see some very radical increases in temperature. The other thing that's really interesting in a soils perspective is this higher incidence of extreme weather events, and that's going to have some potential implications for some very important soil processes. And one of the things about this region is it already has a very risky environment for farmers. And so on top of that, you're going to get an additional increase in impacts on temperature and moisture. So already there's high diurnal temperature variations, there's frost risks, there's low and irregular precipitation, and high risks of drought during the growing season. So on top of that, we're going to get some other changes. So what are some of the consequences that have been predicted for the impact of climate change on soil resources? Well, one of them is already, I think Roberto has some information about this, is that either lower or excessive soil water content during critical periods of the growing season. And so here we have a situation where we already have potential for drought, but on top of that, we may get extreme events where we get really high precipitation in a region which is mountainous. And so this can lead to large-scale soil erosion and mudslides. And so this is potentially in areas where we do have high population, this could be quite risky. The other one, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about, is increased soil organic matter loss. That was another one that was alluded to in Angie's talk. And of course, this phenomena is directly related to the higher soil temperature. But again, as she mentioned, some of this is going to vary by the by elevation. And as I mentioned already, increased soil erosion in a very mountainous regime is one that could be very consequential for loss of soil fertility. Another one that is happening, and we've done a fair amount of assessment of this, is the change in the cropping practices with some possible deleterious effects on soil properties. One of the difficulties here, and that's why it's so important that we work in teams to evaluate this, is it's very difficult in evaluating whether some of this is due to social and economic effects or due to climate change. And so in many times when we're working on this, we've been trying to look at why certain things are happening. And sometimes it's due to some changes in population, for example. Sometimes it's due to changes in climate. So this has been a difficult one to tease, and it relates back to that diagram I was showing you, in which we have this management and climate impacts that work together. The other one, which I think I worry about considerably, are these increased landslides and mud flows. Any of you have been to La Paz, where it's sort of basically situated on the side of a mountain. And I don't know if you've seen it, Roberto, but I've seen in the city itself areas where there obviously has been some loss of soil coming down from the mountain. And so when we get these high rainfall events, the extreme events, which Angie is showing that are going to be occurring, this could be very large impacts on that. And this is where, the issue of soil organic matter is one where, it's quite complicated, because if we do get loss in soil organic matter, And this is a diagram that is from WOW. One of the things we do see is some big impacts on both soil physical, biological, and chemical factors in soils, which lead to loss of productivity. But there's also a feedback on this. So if you do have these, it also causes a feedback because obviously soil organic matter requires organic materials to go back into it. So if you lose your net primary productivity due to these losses of these soil properties, then you're going to have a general decline that sort of spirals down, and you're going to have lower productivity in general. And so one of the things we have to be very careful about when we're predicting and linking with our climate models is understanding better these particular cycles as well. And this is where coupling the climate model with our soil organic model, a matter model, or our crop model are very important. Here's an example, and we already had some data from that, and actually that, I think those maps were much better than the maps I have, Roberto, so I should borrow those from you. But basically, potato late blight is one that's been studied quite a bit in this region, and really hasn't been one that's been impacting high elevation areas in the region. And of course, it can cause major famine, as we've seen in earlier times. And when the inoculum is present, the risk of disease is strongly influenced by humidity and temperature, and that was something that that Angie talked about. Of course, a lot of these areas are fairly dry in the higher elevations and cool, but if we get a change in temperature and humidity, that's going to alter that relationship. So these climate change impacts are one that we really want to be able to evaluate and see what impact they will have on the occurrence of this potato late blight. And we noticed, and Angie has already talked about this, that these elevation, manipulating elevation of where you plant is one thing that has been widely used by farmers to avoid some of the problems associated with climate change. But what we're seeing is that some of these high disease risk zones might shift to these higher elevations. And so they're going to have to adapt to that new problem. And this is a map that Adam Sparks developed that takes a disease model and uses one of the scenarios, the climate scenarios, and predicts what's going to happen in Peru and Bolivia in this Altiplano area in terms of late blight incidents. And as you see, it's not so clear. I think I like your map better, Roberto, that you know where the higher late blight incidence is going to be in some of these higher elevation areas. The other thing that Karen Garrett was sharing with me is the impact of climate change on some of the traditional methods that we use to avoid disease. And so one of the ways that it's normally done is you use mixtures of varieties to avoid the problem. And there's been studies where they've looked at fairly short season locations and very long season seasons, and look to see when what the impact of having mixtures are in terms of the response of late blight. And one of the things that you find is when you have a shorter, when you're going to have a longer season, the mixtures tend to not work as well. And so in terms of here's the longer season, we're seeing is that the disease has been increased in the mixtures. So one of the methods we traditionally use for trying to reduce this problem is actually with a longer growing season not working as well. Now one of the things, because you know we've been all doom and gloom, you know, so I wanted to talk a little bit about some adaptations that potentially could be used to to deal with these consequences on soils of climate change. Well, one of the things we learn from when we work in these regions is that farmers have developed a lot of strategies already to adapt to climate extremes, and one of them is use of genetic diversity. This is quinoa, and there's just a very large diversity in this cereal crop in this region. The other thing is it's a very detailed knowledge among the indigenous people that we surveyed of differential impacts of climate events among their different soil resources based on their own soil classification, and also across the elevation gradients. So one thing that I think Angie talked about was that farmers were moving up in response to the warming so that they could have the potato then initiate the tuber growth. And then one of the things we also realized that these successful adaptation strategies are going to require community participation. And one of the things we do know is that there's a lot of, there's a real limited availability of resources, and these need to be there for these to be successful. And then they have to be coupled with community training and support for adoption of the new practices. I remember working in one of the communities, and the farmers were telling us that oftentimes the technology would be dumped there, and then there wouldn't be a lot of training, and so they were unhappy about not having the training coming with the technology so that they could adapt that to their conditions. So what are some of the adaptations that could be used? And currently, a lot of these are followed. Some of them, of course, have age-old technology involved with them. First one would be soil water conservation measures to capture and reduce the soil moisture loss. And of course, anyone who travels around this region sees a lot of the terraces that are all over the region. And of course, this was a fairly successful technology for hundreds of years, but one that would be needed to deal with the soil moisture loss. The other reason for adopting these soil conservation measures is to reduce the potential soil erosion and landslides that are going to occur with the global warming. And another important aspect of this, if there is going to be greater drought conditions, is to have some improved irrigation methods that are appropriate for this region. And one that's been looked at is deficit irrigation. One that I'm very interested in exploring because what we do notice is there is a lot of potential for trying to introduce soil organic matter is the use of alternative multi-purpose plants that would provide forage, soil fertility, and ground cover. Because very often there's long fallow periods where there's unimproved fallow. And we've learned from, for example, from agroforestry that improved fallow systems work very well. Some other potential adaptations would be alternative soil preparation practices. And of course, this is going to be one discussion that's going to occur later on, which would be some of these conservation tillage practices. And then, you know, a lot of this is also requires some alternative crop species and varieties, in this case, some that are short season and drought and frost tolerant. And one of the things that we do know, and this is part of this spiraling down of the soil degradation due to loss of soil organic matter, that part of the problem is need for increased soil fertility inputs. And alternative organic amendments would be really important because there's simply not enough organic material from livestock manure that can be applied to meet the soil fertility needs. And then one that is a big problem, I think we could see this across the world, is issues with improved crop residue management. One of the problems we observe here is that often there are alternative competing needs and uses for crop residues. And so how do we develop a system where farmers can take the crop residues and put them back into the soil when they have competing needs for these materials, such as for livestock? So this is some area that I think would be really important to develop. And of course, here is one of the real strengths of this region is the genetic diversity, and maintenance of that genetic diversity is going to be very important. Farmers often have, in many cases, traditionally have planted many different varieties in the same field just to overcome a situation of climate that's highly variable. Okay, I'm just going to briefly talk about some knowledge gaps and needs that I've identified over the course of our work, and I'm sure Roberto, who's actually, I think, involved in trying to deal with some of these. One is the biggest problem that I notice in this region is really an insufficient inventory of the soil resources in the region. It's very difficult to improve land use management and evaluate climate change impacts when you really don't know what soil resources you have. So really important here to have a basic soil survey that can be used as a baseline for management decisions. And then evaluation of a wide range of agricultural practices, both indigenous and introduced, and looking at what their effectiveness would be, their short and long-term productivity, and their appropriateness for local agroecosystems and markets. Of course, notice that this is going to require multiple disciplines involved in doing this, and that's why these kind of team approaches are important. And then one of the ones that we've been working on, and we could talk a lot more about that, is some of the management practices that focus on trying to increase soil organic matter. Not only is this important for soil fertility, but I think it's also important for increasing soil resilience to buffer against the climate change. And then one of the things that we think is very important, which it really hasn't occurred as much and can really be done in more large-scale way, is to really look at the long-term impacts of climate change in the region using some soil simulation models. Okay, and they're going to incorporate some of the parameters and climate change scenarios developed for the region. This kind of focus, I think, is pretty critical. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we've got a few. If there's any questions, it doesn't necessarily have to be for me or for other speakers as well. Yeah.
It's really interesting to see the new work that the transdisciplinary team is doing there in the Ottawa. Mm-hmm. Really great. I have two comments and one question. One is, and thank you for sharing the invitation to the book launch and reception that is tomorrow. This is Daniela Pellel, and I have a new book on which came from a symposium last year at the meetings on climate change and agroecosystems.
So we'll be in this situation next year. We'll be plugging.
Right. So that's at 5:30 tomorrow in room 103A, and everyone is welcome the first thing. Second thing is, this speaks to, in part, your fourth bullet there, is that we are just, a new project is just getting going called AgMIF, which stands for Agricultural Model Intercomparison and Improvement Project. What's very interesting about that linkage to the glaciers is that there's a potential for possibly more hydrological resources, more water resources for a while, but then with actually a threshold, with actually then a cutoff and depletion. So I want to see if you've been including that or if you've been able to document anything.
Why don't we get Roberto to talk, because, you know, he is in the region. Go ahead, Roberto. And I think it's very interesting, just from my observation, that this sets up a potential for conflict between rural and urban populations, because, of course, the water is also going to the cities. And, of course, they're really concerned about water availability. And so what's going to happen between when they're trying to get that water to the city as compared to the needs of the rural population? So there's potential for conflict to occur there as well. All right, great. Yeah.
I'd like to just make a comment on this going up the mountains in the Andes, because it's not only a factor of climate change or temperature change. People have been going up the slopes for some time now, before we were talking about climate change, because they were degrading the soils further down. Mm-hmm. So they've been going up, following the fertility and with the problem of release of carbon dioxide.
Is that happening in Africa as well?
I don't know the mountain areas in Africa, but Bolivia, for instance.
Yes.
Very well.
All right. Any other comments or questions?